Okay, guys. So the next topic I want to move into is one of the farthest-reaching topics in Shas. It appears in different forms in many, many different masechta at many places, and that's the question of mamona mutal b'safek. Now, what is mamona mutal b'safek? No. Mamona mutal b'safek is, yes, is how do you resolve cases of monetary law where you don't know the answer firmly, meaning we have ways of knowing things 100% in halacha. So, for example, how do we know things in halacha? Things like witnesses or a shtar, or an unchallenged shtar. All those are classic cases of monetary law. And in there, the halacha is pretty simple. If Reuven and Shimon say that Levi borrowed money from Yehuda, and they come on the day when it should have been paid back, right? Barring a case in which if it's after the due date, so then we'll assume he paid it back. But if they come within the time, right, they can establish that he owes money. If you have a shtar, things like that. That's how we prove things in halacha. But there are all types of cases in halacha where we aren't sure. And we'll see them. I assume at least some of you have seen some of the classic sugyas on this. Some of you probably learned Bava Metzia at some point, the beginning of Bava Metzia. The first mission in Bava Metzia is all about this, right? Shnai Mochzen Betalit. If two people are holding on to a cloak, a piece of clothing, Zeomer Shali, Zeomer Kula Shali, Zeomer Kula Shali. This one says it's mine, this one says it's mine, so you divide it. But all types of cases, we'll see a case of multiple shtarot with the same date on it. What happens if you buy an animal and it gives birth and you're not sure whether it gave birth before or after it was sold, right? All types of cases. And as we'll see, to briefly outline it, the Gemara will introduce several models. One is what's called Yachloku. What's Yachloku? Divide. Right? There's another mechanism called Alim Givar, which is whoever is stronger wins. We'll see exactly what that means, but yes, called Alim Givar. The court basically says, fight it out, whoever wins, enjoy. Called Alim Givar. Shuda de Diane, or Shuda de Daini, whatever, probably more like Shuda de Diane, but whatever, which is, it's a machlokas, as we'll see in the Rishonim, but something like the judges have leeway to make whatever decision they want. Exact parameters, the machlokas, Rashi tells us in the Karban Eida. There's Munach Ashiyavo Eliyahu, right, which is leave it and do nothing until Eliyahu comes, or that they figure it out themselves. But basically, you know, it's frozen in time. So we have all types of mechanisms to deal with it. Now, when I was in Shan Aleph, so as an introduction to the sugya, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein pointed to the Gemara that I gave you today in Sanhedrin Daf Vav. I'm going to present his analysis, though I'm going to tweak it a little bit with my own. Okay? Rav Moshe points to this Gemara, which is not talking about Mamona Mutal B'Safek at all. It's talking about compromise. But he thinks that this Gemara is a good place to start because it highlights the values that the court system is based on, from which we can start to understand the different mechanisms that we use in cases of Safek. Now, before we look at the Gemara, I think he's 100% right, but I think you have to add an element here, which is, why is it important, broadly speaking, to understand the underlying principles of the Jewish legal system in order to understand how we deal with Mamon HaMutal B'Safek? Right, why does that make sense? Before we get to compromise, why, broader question, why do I think it's important to understand the general principles of the legal system in order to understand Maman Amuto Lusafe. Compromise is going to be the lens through which you're going to look at, but why is this important methodologically? So I would put it slightly more, which is, if you want to find a solution to what type of problem? Yeah, I think that's the key, right? Is that, tell me whether this is what I thought years ago, and I still think it makes sense, but which is the following. Usually, most times when you deal with law, you don't really need to know the underpinnings of the legal system in order to adjudicate the law. Okay? Let me give you an example. If you, Ezra grows up to be a traffic court judge. Very exciting. I hope you don't find this offensive, but okay. And, you know, it's a open and shut case. They have a camera that says that the person ran a red light. It wasn't like at all near when the, like, you know, it had been red for 30 seconds and he just ran the red light. There's no, right, no claims of him running to an emergency. They're not going to the hospital. They're not anything. He just ran a red light. And so he gets a ticket. So what's the law? He pays the ticket, whatever the law is, right? If it's once, pay the ticket. If it's, you know, there's like laws in the system. If it's twice, so then, you know, you suspend the license, you get points, whatever the rules are, they are, and you just apply them. Ezra does not need to be an expert to judge this case in highway safety, in road safety, and definitely not in constitutional theory, right? Like, he needs to know the laws in front of him, and he can adjudicate them, right? Simple laws don't require people to really understand what's going on. They just need to understand the law on the books and then apply it. Why is it that when things are questionable, they make it up from the court to the state supreme, to the appeals court, to the Supreme Court, right? Why there? Not the facts. Not just the facts. But pretty much when anything is besuffic, that's when you, right, when you can't just rule on something black and white, that's when you start invoking first principles. Right? Because you, right? Similarly, who else invokes principles? Legislatures, right? Because a legislature isn't just applying an old law, they're creating law. Right, whenever basically you can't just apply the law as it is in an easy black and white fashion, you need to at least have an awareness of principles. So I think that the reason a regular case of DNA Momonot, in order to understand the best way to adjudicate it, mostly what you need to know that law. Right? You need to know that law. So, you know, if you want to figure out when someone has to pay their rent bill, on the first of the month or the last of the month, all you need to do is figure out whether in this country the expectation is that you pay on the first of the month or the last of the month, right? And then if they pay late, then you got to figure out what the standards are, fines and, you know, and evictions and things like that. But you don't need to understand the underlying principles of the system. That, if you have a problem with the underlying principles of rental law, so take it up with the legislature. I take it up at the voting booth and let them change the law. But if you are now dealing with the law, you just need to understand what it is. But when there's doubt, when things are unclear, so you can't just easily apply the law. So therefore, what helps you figure out what the best thing to do is when you're unsure is principles. Right? It's principles. And because Mamon Amuto Lusafek, the broader sugya is exactly this question, which is when it's not 100% clear what the right answer is, what principles guide us, that's why I think it's particularly here that it's important to ask the broader question, which is, well, what is our legal system trying to accomplish? Because once you figure out what our legal system is trying to accomplish, so then you can begin to understand, well, how should we formulate decisions in these cases of doubt? Does that make sense? You don't have to just say yes. Does it actually make sense? That when we're not dealing with a black and white application of certain law, that's when you have to start thinking about principles. I think that makes sense. Meaning, I think that's true in general. And that's why I think this shiur by Ramosha had resonated with me as much as it did. When I first heard it from him, when I was doing Bava Basra, and I've invoked it whenever I learned this sugya since then, which has been, you know, whatever. I was in Chanel a while ago. Okay. So the context of this Gemara, though, is not Maman Amud de Besafek. What's the context of the Sugya Rami? Compromise. Now, I want to be very clear. This is compromise in the context of court. Okay? Meaning what? Everybody agrees that what? If Ellie and Ezra have a monetary dispute and they decide it's not worth their time to go to court, or their friends, they really don't want to, right? They don't want to threaten their friendship by fighting this out in court, and they just want to compromise. Everyone agrees that they can do that. That's fine. That's great. That's not what they're dealing with. Because what you want to do in your own private life, I don't care. Meaning, Ezra borrowed money from Ellie. And now, they're arguing about whether he paid it back or not. So, if Ellie wanted to, he could just waive the loan. Right? I mean, he can do whatever he wants. He can waive the loan. He can decide to demand what he thinks are his full rights, or he can say, look, you know, maybe you're right, maybe you did pay back and I forgot, you know, give me half. And Ezra said, yeah, maybe I forgot, maybe I thought I paid back and it was a dream, I don't know, okay, we'll split the difference, pay half, right? Or, you know, how many times do friends say, you know, oh, you borrowed $5 from me, you know what, whatever, just put $5 in staka, right? No, you've never done this. Okay, not $5, fine. You have a quarter, right? You have a whatever, right? And then friends will say, sure, just put it in stock or something in my name, in my schuss, no? That you never, okay, maybe I have former friends, I don't know, right? But everyone agrees that you can do that. So if you just look at Rashi on the second line of the Gemara, Rashi says, Asur Litzoa, it's Asur to compromise, Mishabo Lidid. Meaning once they can't come to court, Asur Lidayanin Litzoa. The court cannot impose compromise or mediation, essentially, right? Right? Bitsua could be compromised, but in American legal terms, it's probably more court-mandated mediation. Okay? Right? Do we know what mediation is? Arbitration? I know America doesn't have, like, super involved laws like this. Canada has much more. What? I mean, yes, in halakha, but mediation is court. You can have court mediation, which basically you bind yourself, not necessarily to the strict letter of the law, but you have the court or legally recognized mediators who basically come up with a decision, and then once they come up with a decision, it's recognized by the law. It's binding. Right? In some cases, you have to sign binding arbitration agreement. In some cases, you don't. Right? Meaning, in this is less true in America, but in Canada, the court can instruct you to go to mediation. Right? And then the mediator has legal standing whether or not you sign arbitration agreement because the court has mandated that power out to the mediator. Right? I had a chavrusa in Toronto who I learned with once a week who that was what he did. He is a lawyer, but he spends most of his days these days as a mediator, right? As a court-recognized mediator. No, so in America, it's arbitration, where you have to sign a binding arbitration agreement, right? You can, right, they're doing, it's binding because of your contract, right? I don't know how much, I'm not fully
read up on in America and or state by state probably whether the courts can send you to mediation. I know in Canada they can, and they encourage it because the courts are overwhelmed, but yes, Bezdin acts as an arbitrator. But again, the way it works in America is you have to sign binding arbitration agreements, right? Because they're not necessarily going to be recognized. People do that. It saves them a lot of money sometimes, right? Because, well, you know lawyers' fees, right? Lawyers' fees are a lot. You know, halavai, mechanchim got paid at that rate, you know, like, right? What? I'm saying lawyers get paid, you know, $500-$600 an hour per lawyer in the room. So if you have like a complicated corporate agreement, you know, a 5-minute meeting with 10 lawyers, well, you do the math, right? Like, and forget it, you have a 3-hour meeting with 5 lawyers at $500 an hour, you know, and you do that every day for 6 months. Right? Yeah. So that's why some people do arbitration. But the Gemara is talking about once someone comes to court. So the Gemara says, Rilazar ben Osher Rabbi Yosi HaGlili Omer, Asur Liv Tzawa, is forbidden for the court to initiate compromise, mediation. Asur. Asur. Not just Asur. V'chara botzeya, and anyone who suggests compromise or compromises, hare ze chote. He is a sinner. V'chara hamivarech ala botzeya, and if you bless him, you praise him, oh wise mediator, hare ze minna'et. You are expressing how much you despise God. And for this, the pasuk says that what they're playing on it is not what it literally means, but one who compromises and is blessed, God hates him. Ella yikov hadin et hahar. What is yikov hadin et hahar? May it pierce the mountain, right? May it pierce the mountain. Right? Uproot, but pierce is literally what it is. Right? Right? Like, what? Yeah, I know. I know what you want. But it may also mean that, but Yikova did it a hard. Let it pierce the mountain. Now, arguably, which mountain is it talking about? Har Sinai. Arguably Har Sinai. Right? Arguably, that is the image here. V'chein Moshe haya omer Yikov hadin et ahar. And that's what Moshe used to do. Aval Aharon, Oev Shalom, Virodef Shalom, Umeisiv Shalom, Ben Adam Lechaviro. But Aharon didn't have Moshe's tendency. He pursued peace, loved peace, would make peace. Shenamar Tarat Emet Haitabifu, La Lo Nsa Bisvatav, Vishalom Uvimishor Halach, Iti Virabim Heshiv Me'avon. That the Torah of truth was in his mouth, right? There was no iniquity found in his mouth. With peace and with justice or uprightness, he went and he returned many people away from sin. Now, the Gemara then tells you several other possibilities of what Botzea Berach Nietz Hashem might mean. We'll run through them, even though they're not relevant to us. Another case of this sort of corruption is where someone steals wheat, grinds it up, and then is mafresh challah. And then he makes a bracha on afresh challah. Case of mevarech. Har ein ze mevarech al menoid. Vazanemar ze berach nid tashem. Remeir omer, lo nemer botel keneged Yehuda. Alternatively, talking about Yehuda, shenemar vayimar Yehuda lachav, ma betza kinarog et achinu. That he had said, what monetary gain do we get if we kill our brother? And to bless or praise Yehuda is despicable. Okay. Shita 2. Reb Yehoshua ben Korcha Omer. Mitzvah liv tzoa. It is a mitzvah to bring about mediation and compromise. Shene emar, as it says, emet umishpat shalom shiftu bisha'arechem. as it says, truth, peace, truth, justice, and peace shall be judged in your gates. V'hallo b'makom sheyesh mishpat ein shalom. U'makom sheyesh shalom ein mishpat. Where there is justice, there is no peace. Where there is peace, there is no justice. Ella, ein mishpat ella, I'm sorry. Ella ezu mishpat sheyesh bo shalom. So what justice has peace? Have a omer zebitsua. It's compromise. It's mediation. David omer David said mishpat estaka. David would do mishpat estaka. V'lo kol makom sheyesh mishpat ein staka utstaka ein mishpat. Where there's peace, there's no justice, and there's just no peace. Ela ezu mishpat sheyesh bo staka. Have a omer zebitsua. Okay. Let's stop there for a minute. Okay. Are people interested, before we get into the jurisprudential part of this, to take a moment and talk about the metaphysical claims of law that are being made here? What? Well, before we get to the jurisprudential point. Okay, well, what? Fine, I'll take a minute on it. What? Yeah, I know. Who would have thunk, right? So briefly, the metaphysical point here. So in the same book that I mentioned to Ellie on Monday by Christine Hayes, What's Divine About Divine Law? So she points to this Gemara as one of the places in Shas, where you have to look if you want to understand whether Chazal were nominalists or realists. What do I mean, nominalists or realists? Meaning, do they think, well, a few questions, right? One is the nominalism versus realism question, right? Which is, does law here reflect, does the application of law reflect some sort of reality out there? Right? That's one. And the second is the question that we briefly talked about on Monday, which is Torah in any way, shape, or form identical to natural law, right? Like the right, rational law. So she says that this Gemara is one of those you have to look at for obvious reasons, because let's focus on the second day in the Gemara. And the second day in the Gemara says you should try to compromise. What does that shita seem to say about whether law is real, about the identity of God's law with natural law and natural morality and things like that? What does it seem to say? Right, very clearly. I mean, the second one clearly holds that the Torah is not identical with natural law in the Greek sense, meaning like the right moral truths that permeate reality, because it's saying that the right thing to do is to not keep the law, right? Is to find it, right? That the law would be the less than ideal expression of God's will, which means that the Torah, right? Meaning the straight application of Torah law is not God's ideal application of the law. Right? I mean, that's what it's saying. It's saying, even though this is clearly the law, this is a just thing, according to the letter of halacha, you should try, as a judge, to get the litigants to not demand the law. Right? Which means that this, like, Greek notion that the ultimate law would be, you know, reflective of like the ultimate truths of the universe that you could independently analyze from reason, that are objective morality, all the things that come wrapped up with natural law, the shita that says it's good to compromise and avoid the application of Torah law is saying that the Torah clearly isn't that. Right? The totality of the system, and God may care about principles that are not ensconced in the strict letter of the law. But that means that the law itself is not identical with the objective right thing to do, because you're supposed to avoid it if you can. Right? So at some level, this machlokes, metaphysically, may first of all be, can you imagine in any way, shape, or form that the Torah is identical to, equal to, rational morality, natural law, the things that are objectively the best way for the world to live? The second sheet clearly thinks not. Right? That under many circumstances, it is better to actually avoid the application of the law. The first shita might not hold that, right? The first shita might say no, that no matter what happens, the right thing to do is to express the objective law of the Torah. That's the best thing to do, which maybe you could read as more identifying the Torah as like, you know, natural, right, the natural law or the objective morality, maybe, right? Maybe. Even there, it's not clear, because as Rashi notes, this is only once you show up in court. Right, it's only once you show up in court. Before you get to court, you can do whatever you want, which means that, like, there's no... It may just be that a judge isn't allowed to do this. The other thing is that she, you know, points here is that you have to think about nominalism and realism, right? Which is there, like, some objective law out there that we're trying to mimic? Again, the second law seems to not really be that way, or at least we're not bound to it, because there's a law, and then what we want to do, and we don't have any interest in them corresponding. Right? Meaning we know what the mishpat is, we're just not keeping it. Right? Because we don't think it's the right thing in this world. But I won't get too much into the nominalism-realism thing, because whatever. This is probably not the best example here, but it definitely is a good example of this question of whether you think that... you know, halacha has to be identical with the moral law or not, where the second sheet clearly thinks that not, no, right? Again, the Torah system as a whole may respect it, and that's why we might want you to compromise. But the law itself is not that. But let's focus on the jurisprudential points here, okay? Where'd Rami go? I just don't want him to miss this point. It's fine. I mean, whatever. He went in for whatever he did, you know. I assume he went to the bathroom or something, but still. Yeah, I would pull out the actual passages where she talks about this, but I'll leave it for now. This is always the danger. I ask where someone is, I lose a second person to find that person. Then we do this forever. Okay. I'm assuming in the moment we have share tomorrow. If it's a miracle and you guys, you know, get on the insurance company and manage to get on the bus to go to the middle of nowhere to get vaccines, then I have been informed there won't be share. I've also been informed that it's not so likely that it'll happen tomorrow, but you never know. If all the paperwork goes through, then maybe. What? You can have it next week. It could happen anytime. I don't know. Yeah, same thing. Same thing. Same thing. Okay, you went to Meuchedet, which was 16 Leif Ha'ir. Klalit is in 14 Leif Ha'ir. One building over. If you keep going, the next building, it's there. Kalit and Maccabi are in 14. Or 12. All I know is I went into one of them when I meant to go into Mulchadet. So it's like a building or two over. 12 or 14, okay? That I have no idea. I'm on Mulchadet. I have no idea. Yeah, it's going through a broker. The broker will speed it up for you, I hope. Okay, anyways. Back to tomorrow. So, let's go backwards here. Let's focus on the position of Rav Shmuel ben Karachah that mitzvah livtsoah.
Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, how did he get there? He has a very fascinating claim that gets him to the principle that compromise is ideal. What is his very fascinating claim? Right? What is, he doesn't just say, yeah, compromise is great. What does he say? I want you to spell out what he says. I don't want you just to repeat the words. He's saying something very profound, and I want you to get at what he's saying. Okay, so let's flesh that out. There are psukim that talk about mishpat. There are psukim that talk about shalom. But what's the problem? He has a fundamental problem that he needs to solve, and that is that b'makom sheyesh mishpat ein shalom, b'makom sheyesh shalom ein mishpat. What does that mean? Very good. Right? He says there seem to be two values articulated in the legal system here. One is shalom, peace. What does peace mean? What does it mean to value peace? What does it mean? In not like theory, in a court, what would that mean? That the ultimate goal of the court, if it were pursuing an agenda of shalom, would be to make sure that by the end, Eli and Ezra walk out still as friends, regardless of what happens. Right? And the likeliest way of that happening is a shtickle compromise. Right? As we all know, a little bit of compromise, everyone claimed they won a little bit, and everyone's happy. Right? Or everyone's mad. I remember when I was in Rambam, the mock trial coach said he had this case that had been going on. It was two Chabadnikim against each other in court, and they'd been fighting for a while, and then they finally reached a settlement, and when they reached the settlement, they were all happy, and he burst out laughing, and none of the non-Jews in the courtroom understand what was so funny. What was so funny? They settled for $770,000, right? That was what they decided to settle for. Oh, please, you don't know this? Chabad Central in Brooklyn is 770, right? This is like the holy Chabad number, 770, right? And so, like, they were happy because they decided they'd compromise on, like, the holy number, right? 770. You don't understand. It's like, you if you go into Yerushalayim, the Chabad in Yerushalayim, they pay fines every year because they break the law by not having it with Jerusalem stone, so they can use the stones that make it look like 770 in Brooklyn. Right? It's like a, right? They're very into, like, 770. Anyways, but compromise makes people happy. Whatever, you know, you settle on whatever, and you settle, you're happy. So a court agenda that was committed to peace as its super value, as its uber value, would be one that would be willing to give up the strict letter of the law. Its main goal, when you finish at the end of the day, is that Ezra and Eli walk out happy and friends. Good. What would an agenda of mishpat look like? Yeah, whoever's right, they get whatever the law entitles them, right? Doesn't matter what. If it means that Eli owes Ezra $1,000, but it's going to take 6 months in court and $300,000 in court expenses and lawyers' fees in order to get that, it doesn't matter. The judge's job by the end of the day is to make sure that when he adjudicates the law, whoever deserves whatever he deserves gets whatever he deserves, and that's all that matters. Justice, right? It doesn't matter. And then, one second, then he makes two points, a two-staged argument that Ezra very nicely captured, but let me break it down even smaller into smaller units. He then makes two claims. One, these don't normally coexist. peace and justice are normally at odds. Right? Peace and justice are normally at odds. If what you care about is the truth and justice, good luck on maintaining peace and vice versa. And we know this from human experience. This is often true, right? If, let's say, in Yavoh Yom, you'll be married, right? And you and your wife, I've been picking on Ellie and Ezra, so now Yaakov. When Yaakov is married, him and his wife have a basically egalitarian implied agreement of housework. Okay? Right? They're good modern people. And they plan on splitting housework. Okay? So they have two ways they could deal with it. They could, more or less try to split. Or they could keep count, and they could assign points to washing dishes and to cooking weekday versus Shabbos, cleaning the floor, cleaning the toilets. Each one thing gets a point number, right? And you keep track and make sure that at the end of every 24 hours or every week, right, that you're equal number of points. Now, oh, very good. So one of those is going to lead to shalom, right, which is, we have an agreement, and we don't enforce it too much. That's shalom, right? A marriage which tried to live by the point system would end in failure very quickly, because mamakom shein mishpat, sheish mishpat ein shalom, right? But what's the problem? Ezra, but what's the problem? And what's his second move? He then makes another move that's very important, which is, but there are psukim that seem to imply that they can coexist, and therefore they must coexist. So then you got to figure out, but wait a second, how can they coexist? Right? His answer is compromise. That compromise is not what you thought of originally. Compromise is not giving up truth for the sake of peace. What is it? What is it, Ezra? It's the giving up of strict justice in favor of, right? Meaning it's basically claiming that it's not true that justice is an all or nothing proposition. That was the Hava Amina. It's not true that compromise is the opposite. It's strict justice is the opposite of peace. But compromise isn't necessarily outside the realm of law. It is also possible to have a compromise, a mediation, which is reflective of peace, that incorporates peace. It may not demand strict justice, but it's not unjust. They can live in tension and even in fruitful cooperation. Now, based on that, what Rabbi Yeshua ben Karachai can be taken one step farther, which is to say, okay, what then is the purpose of the legal system? What does the court want to pursue? What is central to its existence, Ezra? According to Rabbi Yeshua ben Karachai, if I asked you, what are the guiding principles of the Jewish legal system, what would you tell me? What? Right. Meaning Din and Emet Shalom, in which the Gemara seems to think that Din and Emet are basically overlapping. Meaning strict justice is a pursuit of pure truth and peace. Those are two things that the court are responsible to try to bring about, even though they might be in tension. Now, in light of that analysis, explain to me the position of Rabbi Yossi Aglili. Yeah, explain to me Rabbi Yossi Aglili's position that you don't compromise. In meta terms, what does that mean he's saying about the legal system? Very good. Is that it might be very nice to have peace, and if Ellie and Ezra want to compromise before they come to court, that's fine. But once you enter the courtroom, the job of a judge is to judge.
I mean, look, this is not going to map on, obviously, to American politics, but I see already, right, in Romney's head is like, right, the gears are going, is aha, this is a machlokes between the originalists, or maybe not even the originalists, but whatever, people who think that you're just judging the law, maybe even just the original intent, and the people who are okay with legislating from the bench, right? I want to get the right result, right? Okay, originally, there are many different, there are people who think their job is to judge the law, but, and not legislate from the bench, but they also aren't originalists. These are not, right, there are different theories of law. There are different theories of constitutional law. Have you ever studied legal theory? Yes or no? Okay, fine. So the answer is no. Right? And that's why, yes, there are a lot of systems. I mean, there are people who just thought that there are plenty of people who are not originalists but still don't think you should be legislating from the bench. Right? Meaning, I don't, you know, a lot of legal theorists who think that you can't, that originalism is wrong, still don't think you're supposed to be legislating from the bench. Right? Like, Cass Sunstein's view based on Dworkin, right, is, which is not originalism, but I don't think it's, he's not suggesting you legislate from the bench, right, he thinks of law, as he puts it, as, what? It's like a, what's that called, where multiple people write chapters to a book, right, you each write one, what? Not like that, meaning one after the other, what? You know what I'm talking about, where like, you have a novel, and it's written like, Yaakov writes the first chapter, and then Rami has to write a second chapter for it to work, right? He can write whatever he wants, but he's constrained by whatever Yaakov wrote, because otherwise he'll be incoherent, right? There's not a, right? And the third chapter, Gavi will now have to write the story based on how Yaakov and Rami wrote it, right? So he thinks that that's the way to think about law, which is that basically, law develops, right, but it has to, in order for you to be fairly adjudicating law and not making things up, you have to make sure that your interpretation of the law makes sense with the previous layers that have been built. You may be writing a new chapter, but you're not completely free. You're not making it up, right? Meaning, no, you're not making it up. Is that, it's not legislating from the bench. It's basically that law was meant to develop in a way that is coherent with the chapters built before. I'm not sure that there are people who simply legislate from the bench, right? But there are legal theorists who think they're not just legislating from the bench. They are interpreting law. They just think that there are ways of understanding law with integrity that aren't originalism. So the answer is there are many legal theories. That's my point. I'm not endorsing one or the other. I'm just saying that I don't think anyone who's not an originalist is just someone who doesn't care about interpreting law and just legislating the bench. I don't think that's true. They just argue what interpreting law is. I personally am, you know, in many ways sympathetic to originalism, right? Which is not surprising that I'm at least sympathetic to it, right? But I don't think that every other mode of interpretation is legislation from the bench, right? I don't think that's true. I think that there are other legal theories, you know. I have certain sympathies for originalism, admittedly, but so, but you have the first position, Rabbi Yosef Glili, who says, listen, I wanted this. Once you get into the court, your job is to apply the law. However you understand that, but it's to apply it. However you understand applying the law, compromise is not that, right? Mediation is not that. You're not applying the law. Right? Okay. Now, if you just stop there for a minute, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein argued that this discussion already tells you that at least two potential principles that motivate the legal system are justice / truth and peace. That's point one that's important. What's the second one? That these aren't necessarily, that these seem to in many ways be necessarily in tension in their absolute forms. And in an attempt to pay homage to both values, you have to compromise between the values, which creates compromise, right? Now, let's keep that in mind for a minute. Let's finish the Gemara. And then the Gemara says, "Atan lozana kama donen adin zika nazaka v'chiv v'chayev roshin chayev ani mamod v'shilim lo mitoch beito zem mishbaru tzaka mishpat lezet tzaka zem mishpat lezet shilim lo mamod utzaka lezet shilim lo mitoch beito." Then the Gemara says, "I have another suggestion. If you don't believe that, let's say you think that you should pursue absolute justice in court. So how could you have justice and peace? What does he say?" And he seems to, by peace, seem to think something more like generosity or broader equity. Yeah, it's where the judge will say, "Eli, you owe Ezra $1,000, right? And then go to Eli and say, "And here's $1,000 for you, because I know you really couldn't afford to lose that money." So then, within the context of court, he's expressing justice, but outside the context of the court, he's expressing generosity, benevolence, peace, whatever you want to call it, right? Now, that's a model that values both, but says one happens within the confines of law and the other outside, right? And the judge functions at two levels, as a judge and as a member of society, as a, right? Fine. If you skip down, though, you get this very extreme, but in Kashali, the Rebbe, he said, according to that, that's a particular type of justice for poor people, but that doesn't express itself well in for the whole country, for the average person. He says, Ella, he says, no, you misunderstand it. When Eli has to pay Ezra, it is justice and kindness. Why? It's justice for Ezra, who now has his $1,000, and it was kind to Eli, because Eli is a good person, and Eli doesn't want to be holding on to money that he doesn't deserve by law. And it's actually being kind and generous to him to make him give the money to Ezra. I don't know if Eli agrees, but it's kind to him to make sure that he is an upstanding member of society. Say it again? We're talking about monetary law right now. I'm going to stay in the realm of monetary law for now on purpose, because that's what we're talking about. Okay? Now the Gemara makes an important move. The Gemara then introduces several positions to say, look, I'm willing to accept compromise, but the distinction is, what stage of the legal process are you in? Okay? Why does that matter? So, Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh, Omer, let's get them down. Omer, Shnayim Shabanu Lefanecha Ladin. If two people come to court, Ad Shlo Tishma Divrayim. Before you've heard their positions, the claims, or you heard the claims, but you haven't worked out who you think is right, Ata Rashai Lomer Lan Tzu Vitzu. You can say, leave court and compromise. But once you've heard their claims and you know, you have a feeling, you know how it's going to be resolved, then you can't encourage mediation and compromise. Right, the way they read the pasuk is before it's clear to you what the halacha is, then you are allowed to give up the law, let them compromise, but after that you can't. Amar Shnaim Joeludin Echad Rach Vechad Kasha. Similarly, if one of them is harsh and violent and one is not, Atul Jishman Devanish Dish the Rayan Etayode Lechon and Note. Before they come to court, Atul Rashai Lomerlan and Nis Kiklachem, you can say, look, I can't handle this case. Shaman is Chayiv Chazak and Nimsa Chazak Rod Fo. Because then it could be that the, you know, it's the mob, right? And I'm gonna make the mob pay money and then they're gonna come after me. Mishatishma Divrayan, once, however, they, well, you've heard the claims about the Adei Lechem the Note, and you know, you have an idea of where it's going, then you can't do that. You have to judge it, Shneimar Lo Taguru Mipnei Ish, because you cannot be afraid. Right? You're not allowed to be afraid of anyone when you're the judge. Okay. What does this second half of the Gemara tell us? That even if you think you can compromise, what's the difference? Once you've entered court, right, so then you need to judge the law. And once you know what the answer of strict justice is, you need to judge it. But before that, compromise is legitimate. Now, there's a few things that emerge that are important from that claim. One is that, what does that Gemara tell you implicitly? That whatever you think the balance is between peace and strict justice, that calculus changes if you don't know what strict justice is yet. Right? That peace is more legitimate to pursue if you don't know for sure that it is in conflict with justice, because you don't know what the right answer is. Right? Agreed? Yes? Good. Second point here is that the Gemara says that how does he encourage mediation at that point? It seems to be at some level that he vacates the legal role. He encourages them to leave the legal system to do it peacefully. Right? Now you have to figure out how literally to take that. Does that mean that this mediation is viewed as a subsection of the legal system? Right? When it says, sue, get out of here, it really means like, you know, I'm watching under my auspices this is happening, or is it saying, why don't you take a break from the legal system, try something external legal system, but within the legal system, justice is still going to be the supreme value, right? We can quibble about that, but that's going to be important. Okay? With all that insights in mind, let me give you in the last 5-7 minutes here an overview of why I think this is important for Mamon Amos HaBesafek. As you already see at the end of the Gemara, that when things are unclear, that's when it's more legitimate to compromise or talk about different values. With all that in mind, what Ramosha argued is as follows. The Jewish legal system has three concerns. Two are listed in this Gemara, and one is obvious. One is justice. The second, peace. The third is what he called chayim, which is the even more basic role of government, which is just make sure things keep running, right? Just make sure things keep running, right? Those are the three goals of a court. And he argued that all the different principles of Mamon Amuto B'Safek and the Machlokot about them are essentially the Gemara and the Rishonim trying to figure out how you balance these values and under what circumstances one of those values is more dominant than the other. So to give you the very quick overview, but I'll repeat this tomorrow once you get a chance to start looking at it inside. Okay? At first glance, Yachloku, cases where I tell you to divide, which value is that prioritizing? What? Peace, right? It's compromise. In many of those cases, how likely is it that I'm violating truth on the altar of peace? Likely,
right? Not always, and we'll see, but not unlikely, right? But we'll see that the Rishonim are going to argue about when you can do Yachloku. What about Kol Dalam Gvah? Well, Munach HaShiyav Eliyahu, right? Let me take Munach HaShiyav Eliyahu, right? This is, I think, a good counterexample. Saying that I don't know what to do, so let it sit until the end of time, and Eliyahu will figure it out. Which of those three values is it giving the most credibility to? Which is it giving the least credibility to? What? So he says, which one is it totally giving up on? So Ramosha argued Chaim, meaning Yachloku is giving benefit to peace, seemingly, less salience to truth, but it's giving salience to Chaim. It's saying divide it and then move on. Munach HaShiyav Eliyahu was saying, I don't care about life. This can stay in a permanent state of abeyance for the rest of time for all we care, which is a failing, right? What about Shalom or Emet? The answer is, well, it's not, it seems to be taking Emet very seriously. Why? Yeah, it's refusing on principle to act when it doesn't know the answer, meaning it doesn't want to get it wrong. And it's willing to freeze the functioning of society for the purpose of this object, rather than do something that might reflect it on truth. Right? Is it peaceful? Eh. Yes and no, meaning, right? But it's clearly, if I had to put the two main values that are in play, is it's willing, what it's definitely willing to do is give up on the value of society working, right? Chaim, just continuing life, because it doesn't want to violate the value of truth. And we can quibble about Shalom. What about Kol Da'alim Gvar? Kol Da'alim Gvar. Whoever beats the living daylights out of the other person and gets it, keeps it. Yeah, so it's letting society go forward, because by the end of the day, okay, fine, something will have happened. Shalom seems to have been thrown in the garbage, right? What about Emet? Well, we got to figure it out, meaning... Well, is that giving up on Emmet because we're not trying to judge it? Is it respecting Emmet because it's saying we just don't want to deal with it because we don't know the answer and we're willing to, in order to protect the court from doing something unjust, it's willing to let people do whatever they want, and the fact that injustice happens out of court is not our problem. Like we saw in our Gemara, right? That until you know the right answer, it's legitimate to say do whatever you want. Now, in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, that is, until you know the right answer, let them compromise. In the case of Kol Da'alim Gvar, it's until you know the right answer, right? Until you know the right answer, let them fight it out, right? So it seems to be protecting itself on the truth grounds because it's not weighing in, but totally giving up on Shalom, right? Saying, literally, fight it out, right? So I think this is a very helpful framing, right? Taking Ramosha's insight and saying, with my addition, which is when you're dealing with Suffolk, you can't just rely on the strict application of the law, and therefore you have to go to first principles. When you realize that these are the three factors that the court has to take into account, you understand why you might, in different circumstances, while trying to calibrate these values, come to different conclusions, why you might have machlokot about it. Okay? So what I want to do is at least get into some of these, right? Some of these. We're not going to see every case of Muzdal B'Safek. That would take months, and I don't want to kill you like that. But I do want you to at least have a taste of the sugya. Our sugya directly deals with several cases. We're going to focus on the cases as they appear in our Gemara, and we'll look at, like, Tosvos is going to, bring into conversation some of the other Gemaras, and I'll give you some of the other Gemaras, but I'm going to try to focus on the ones here, as the sugya appears in Lamed Daled, Lamed Hey. Okay? Good? Fine.